Oh, fantastic. I think I'll begin with saying I was driving past Rarawa today on my way to get here. Yeah.
Just memories, and it was good to leave though.
Yeah.
I'd been there for 22 years, was my time was up, and
yeah,
I needed new blood in there, I think. Yeah.
Is that both on and on the farm?
Yeah, I think I miss the animals, but I don't miss the farm itself.
Yeah.
They've actually bought another farm next door.
Oh, cool.
Across the river, so they will eventually put deer into it. But
yeah.
I think the road will go through there.
Yes.
The new expressway, which was doing when I left there, but now when the government changed it and don't put it through, but they're actually out there now doing this all the work again that they did when I was there.
Yeah. I think the last round of deer sales I went to when I was living here, you and the back neighbour were talking about what parts of the farm were going to get chopped off.
Yep, yeah, just go right through the middle. Take off 35 hectares. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did Rarawa start, and how did you get involved there?
How did it start? John and Dorothy Carter bought it probably 87. They were investment farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Developed it over a 6 to 12 month period, and then had various managers there in the meantime getting it sorted out and getting buying genetics. And you had deer around the country which they brought in, and how did I get involved? I moved from the Wairarapa to Walton, which was over the back of Matamata.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager of Rarawa and me applied for a job at Temero, which is up in the hills here.
Yeah,
so the manager got the job at Temero, and the guy said, well, I know somebody else who might be looking for a manager, and sent my CV down to John Carter at Rarawa.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is history, yeah.
Yeah.
That was 1998. So, yep. And I was part of the family there.
Yeah.
And when John died, 2012, yep. The son took over in Auckland, so it was a little bit different, but
yeah,
because John, he it was his hobby, and he took a lot of stuff to the grave with him, and the son in Auckland wasn't told anything really.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we had a good reasonable relationship, but it was time for me to move on, and so he's there. He's Luca's running it, but they've got a new manager there.
Mm-hmm.
Got a nice young fella, keen worker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he used to work for Shane Quinn.
Yep, yeah.
The shooting trophies, but that's all he knew about deer when he first got into it, so it was a big learning curve for him.
Yeah.
We spent 6 months together, and everything he knew about Rarawa, I taught him, basically.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
He never velveted a stag, now he velvets 600, so yeah, it's a good learning curve for him, and he's done pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, although some of the stags are out the front there on the road, so they're starting to grow a decent stick already. So yeah.
He's done some already.
Yep.
And we actually went, because he sells to Valco,
mm-hmm.
the co-op in Christchurch, but now that I work for Colin Stevenson's, we thought we'll go and I think they'll make more money if they send it to us, but they actually might get to send some to us. So
yeah,
my job was to go and pick it up when it's ready.
Absolutely.
Hopefully it's all rather than just some of it. Yeah.
So like you said, you had to hand over 20 years of Rarawa in 6 months. What did that sort of look like?
How did it look like? This is where this is, and this is how this paddock runs, and these are the genetics basically.
Yeah.
We didn't have a sale that year because that was when we first went there, because we thought we could make more money out of selling them privately.
Mm-hmm.
And he did.
Mm.
We sold just venison stags and made as much as we did out of the normal sale, and kept all the good velvet stags and good trophy stags.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of selling them.
Mm-hmm.
It was to a Mary Corporation down in Tamaranui, or down in Turangi, and we sold 15 meat stags basically for a good dough.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kept all the velvet stags, and Glenn was a trophy man, so he had contacts for trophies,
mm-hmm.
and sold a heap of trophies, and then COVID hit.
Yeah. So I managed to get along to Grant Charteris's sale and Wilkins as well. And
oh, that was a stag that they bought.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Glenn bought one down there.
Yeah. I was talking to you after that sale, and when you said the one that he picked, I was like, oh, good to know. I was on the right money with what was a good stag there.
Yeah, because there was a guy, the underbidder was a guy in the same advanced party group from Taramanui.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and like he got only paid $15,000 for him, so he...
Yeah.
But he's bought several since down south. Velvet stags.
Yep. Yeah.
But velvet with big body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to go, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although Venice is not worth not much at the moment. So.
Yeah, golly.
crazy.
So, were you there when Banks was sold?
Yep.
Yeah. So, at the time, what was it about Banks that got him to that record?
Just a massive head for a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And there was Motsumi the year before, which we also bred, which was sold at Rodway in Wairarapa. We sold the hind and calf, and then Motsumi, he made 142,000 as well, but Deer Genetics bought him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was our breeding. And then the next year, Banks was probably a better head as a 2-year-old.
And you got an extra 20 cents, was that right?
To a $22 or something, yeah. But he was such a, like he won a big stag, but yeah. He had a massive head,
mm-hmm.
but a good even head. And yep, it was, there's plenty of them around now,
mm-hmm.
but that was so early in the piece. What made him good? It was just a nice big even head, but a big head for a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And he was a nice placid stag, in the pen with him. TV cameras afterwards in the paddock. Yeah. And then he went on to breed, but he wasn't looked after very well.
Okay, yeah. So what sort of phase of things was happening there? You said it was big and clean. That was purely about velvet then? And
yeah, it was still velvet. We'd gone and actually the trophy industry buggered the velvet really, because if we'd stuck to velvet like probably Grant has,
mm-hmm.
good beams, good thick beams, and good velvet. Trophy stag tends to not have a good velvet head.
Mm-hmm.
But Don had made a decision that he wanted to go trophy ways as well, because with Don Bennett, and he was the trophy man in those days with Deer Genetics before he went. He lived in Rotorua. He was Kaurua.
Mm-hmm.
So he got John into trophies, and it was sort of. Yep, it was trophies, venison and velvet in those days. Banks was the start of that, really.
Yeah. And we're trying to get that in all in one animal, or?
Anyway, the ideal thing was, his ambition was to grow a big stag for venison with a thick antlers for velvet and for multi-head for a trophy. And I think we did that.
Yeah.
In some of our big stags. When I left Rotorua, there were some of the big boys there had big velvet and big trophy head as well.
Mm-hmm.
We were just lucky, but that was his John's ambition was to big and got everything.
Yeah. So what was it like the first time you got in the pen with stags?
I'd had a little bit of experience before I got to Rara.
Yeah.
But getting in, I remember back in the 80s, tried to cut them and spikes off spikers, when we didn't know that was it had gone that they'd gone hard by then. In between double gates, you get one off, and then the gates cut, and you couldn't get your women loppers. And we were doing them with loppers, it was crazy in those days.
Mm-hmm.
The stags respected you, and you knew the stag that wasn't going to respect you.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell that with instinct, I don't know, but as soon as you went into the pen, you knew that. Either they were a mate or they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And Letty has always carried a little shield with me, and that was my protection.
Mm-hmm. And the nature was in the breeding.
People will say you can breed temperament out of. I think it's a lot in the handling.
Mm-hmm.
like we've sent stags away and they say, oh, he's been a wild bugger or something, but it's different environment.
Yeah,
they're a wild animal and you've taken them to a different environment, certainly they get to react. But oh yeah, we had the odd one that, and they never hang around very long. You put him on a truck.
How did you find cattle compared to deer?
You could take deer to a gateway, but you couldn't make them go through.
Yeah,
they knew it was open. Cattle would they don't mind. They could see where they were going. It was all right. Whereas deer, if they didn't see where they were going, it was better.
Yeah,
they always, like, you take them out of a paddock, they'd do a right angle down the lane. They think they're escaping. It was all psychological.
Yeah.
Even though their mates could see them through the netting, they'd out the gate and down them. But if you wanted them to go somewhere, you always made it look that they were getting away.
Mm-hmm. And is that right that Ian Scott had a bit to do with that behavioural moving around?
Yeah.
He's a local, eh?
He's a local. Yeah. And Ian's, you know, he's good value, but he's got ideas. And
Yeah,
not my ideas. You know, we always had... deer farming was like psychological.
Yeah.
Yep. If they think they were betting you, they were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Because that was where I wanted them to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because all the sheds were, you know, right angles into the shed, round corners. I never had any trouble with deer going into the shed and come back out again, because the way we had it set up, they were going round in circles.
Yeah. So you said advanced parties there before. What was it like being a part of the foundation of that? And
that was fantastic. And we all learnt off other people, and that's how the deer industry started, by learning off what Joe Bloggs was doing down the road, and he'd learn off what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great group from Tamaranui to Helensville.
Wow, yeah.
And there was nine of us, and we'd meet every month, and that was we always looked forward to that month, whose farm we were going to, and we would pull things apart. And actually, the first one was at Tamaranui, and he spent $30,000 on our recommendation and building a self-feeding pit.
Yeah.
And he reckoned it was the best thing he ever did.
Did you say that was Tamaranui? I think
Blackburn.
Yeah, I think I've read that story in the Deer News.
Alan and Kerry Blackburn, and they were wintering their hinds up on the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, you can take them off the hills and put them on this flat, and he built a self-feeding pit in the middle of. And yep.
And that was right. The hinds just kind of pushed into the gate.
Yeah,
and,
yep.
And fed,
yeah. And then the Wellingtons also they had one as well, and they kept pushing it in.
Mm-hmm.
The Wellingtons was probably the original one. They had wintered their hinds in the pine trees,
mm-hmm.
and then had all their self-feeding pit. We've gone Hawke's Bay to it as well, since sold the farm to Shane.
Oh yeah,
Tim Aiken.
Tim Aiken, yeah. Because that's where I was living next door to last year.
Oh, okay.
Old Tim came into work in Waipukoro, so
yeah,
I got to chat with Tim a couple of times about what he'd done and what Shane was doing going forward. So yeah, it was cool to see.
Yeah.
The fences got raised a little bit. I did notice.
Oh, did I? Because Shane actually, we see Shane's velvet at Seacoast.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is he cuts his young stuff properly, but then some stuff is overgrown, so he can see whether they could be a good trophy or not.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting for them last year. Obviously, they had the hunting season planned, and then the clients couldn't come, so a big whoppity bull got brought back to the farm, clipped off.
Yeah.
He was running around the paddock with a mob of, I think, commercial stags.
Yeah.
And it was interesting watching their behaviour. There was sort of three or four guys, reds, that would escort the whoppity around, and then the other smaller ones would try to get in, and they'd get kicked off by the red. It was almost like, no, we're the guys that can pick on him, and you guys can piss off.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and the same thing's happening this year. I think they're going to grow some out because the American hunters are wanting to pay their deposit just in case they can come.
Yeah.
So they've got, do we grow some out or do we not?
Oh, gee whiz.
he's sold 20 stags to a guy at Button Drop because he's got nothing, and just in case something happens.
So you have trophy guys culled out a bunch of their stags or something?
No, I don't know. They've been selling a lot of the inferior ones New Zealand wide.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've obviously done something. Whether this is a new one, I don't know, but they've got to grow. I know, and Porinui grew their big ones out last year, thinking that something might happen. It obviously didn't.
Yeah. The old elk quarantine is quite the off-putting. You know, you hear about the money that people pay for a trophy stag, especially if it's in that super gold or whatever. What is it, like 1,000 SCI, and then 2 weeks in quarantine is just a no-go.
No. And then a lot of those big trophy guys ended up cutting them in about, I finished in April, in about March, so we had all sort of just before stripping, so we had a lot of half-stripped heads coming in,
yeah,
to CK's, big stuff, and Paul Bamble was the same, he cut all his off as well.
Yeah.
Shane cut all his off just before stripping, so there was some big, not too many fitted in the bin.
Yeah. So what are you guys doing with hard antler?
Hard dog chews.
No, oh, yeah.
Yep.
Trophy head dog chews.
Yeah. Into 90 to 100 grams.
Yeah.
100 to 120 to 200. Yeah. All cut into pieces. You go into pet food places, pet shops, and platinum foods, and some goes to Australasia.
Yeah.
Yep, 40 ton of dog chews.
Yeah, people will be familiar with the Christmas tree trophy head.
Yeah,
I can just see that being cut up into dog chews.
Yeah, it's a lot of it. Yep, you go on a bandsaw.
Yeah.
And he goes all day. Yeah, and then it's all got to be tumbled, and then it's taken to town and baked.
Yeah.
And then which sterilises it, and then wrapped, shrink wrapped
up, and taken to the pet store.
Yeah.
Cool.
But, you know, everything's used.
Yeah. Remarkable piece of anatomy.
Yeah, that keeps coming back every year.
Yeah.
And that's... Like we had a kid come into Raro once with all the heads on the head, and she started crying because she thought that every animal of those heads, the animal had been killed to get the head.
Yeah, so people could go onto my Instagram and see the picture of the, what was it, your sale shed and your...
Yep,
and
sales
all,
complex.
Yep. Yeah, all the sort of years of each head along the way. Yeah.
So a buyer could come in there and see the genetics of the sire, the stag, and the dam sire, really. And so that's why we had them displayed over the years. Yep, every year. That's the beauty of it, that it's, you know, the stag keeps producing.
Yeah. And was there always surprises?
Oh, always, yeah, because until we started growing trophy stags out, we velveted the stag and we never saw their antlers. We did it one year where we grew them out as 2-year-olds. And we could find the good ones then, but then they'd go back into the herd, but then you wouldn't see them again until they're 8-year-old. Yeah, there's always some surprises.
Yeah.
It was good. And then when we started growing them out as 3-year-olds for sale, the 3-year-old theoretically is their best head.
Yeah.
As a young stag. And so that's when I picked up stags to put it back into the herd as size.
Yeah.
I had several that we had a money situation where Luke said, well, why are we spending all this money? And then so I was bringing sires from out of the herd rather than going buying them. So I bought a couple for more genetics.
Things that you'd bred on farm were looking good.
That were of foreign breed, basically, hinds that we'd bought in. But then I think since they've realised that, they've got to get and buy new stags, and they did. They bought it 2 or 3 over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Good stags. Yeah. Good dough.
And so when you came to Rarawa, that foundation of genetics was there?
It was there. They bought a lot of foundation stags, sales from over at Walton, Richmond Downs. Whether they were, some were imported,
mm-hmm.
And John imported a couple as well, as spikers,
mm-hmm.
and different genetics. And of course, then once the AI program started, it was just, the genetics of the New Zealand industry went from there to there real quick.
Yeah.
Because of imported genetics.
Mm-hmm. So as a herd was sort of got well captured, and what was the transition to go, now we're going to push the boundary?
Of course, that's how the deer industry started with, and the genetics were there from the start because they knew exactly, roughly, what areas various animals had come from the UK and released into the wild.
Righto,
early in the piece, and so the foundation genetics were pretty good, English breeding.
Mm-hmm.
So then the stags were imported, and expensive stags were imported, and they put into the herd, and John just kept dabbled in genetics,
mm-hmm.
and he could see something that was, they liked to get in his herd,
mm-hmm.
and he tried a lot of studs, he tried from most, and studs. Anything popped up, he'd buy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those early herds, that they were genetic tested, or when did sort of
when did that start? I don't know. Before I got into the industry, I think there was they started thinking in the reds whether there was any Bim and Wapiti where that got involved early in the piece, and so they'd, because there was a Warnham Woburn Society, they were just pure Warnham and Wobans.
Yeah.
And then you got
and they're like two royal farms from England, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you got Woburn, which is another one,
mm-hmm.
Which is still there. Mm-hmm. Well, they both still there. And then Graham Carr bought it, and Peter Fraser bought in Furzlands, which was a Cornish breed, another stud.
Yeah.
Mouldy pointed.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, probably, or late 70s. Even 80s, when they were women started recording genetics. John recorded genetics the day he bought the farm, and he recorded everything from there on. And he would have known where his original breeds were coming from.
So. Mm-hmm. And so, did John always have aspirations to become a stud himself?
Oh yeah, I think
yeah.
so. Yeah,
yeah,
because he was a mate of Clive Jeremy's.
Clive Jeremy, right?
Yeah, Stanfield.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was your aspiration, was to have a stud.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what drove his decision to buy that farm specifically, or that was just something that came up?
They looked at several farms around, the one across the road from where, across the highway.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at that one, and one down, which is there next to Oliver Farm at Henry Rera.
Towards Tauranga,
where Ian Scott's place is. Mm-hmm. They looked at that one. There was two or three of them they looked at in the Waikato.
Because he's from Wellington, was that right?
Yeah, he was from Wellington, don't know why they... I think it was a nice farm, and to me it would have been a good choice. Compared to the others that they looked at.
Yeah. So all those Waikato deer farms, were they kind of the leftover from the dairy, or what was the story there?
Well, Rara was a sheep farm, and beef. I don't know whether the one down Matamata, Henrira, was deer fenced. I think it was. But they were, was really before dairy really took off, I suppose.
Okay, right.
But I don't know what he was, because he was a mate of Clive, and Clive lived up here, I think.
Yeah.
He said, you've got to come to the Waikato.
The grass grows.
Yeah, well, that's right. Everything grows, yeah. So that was why they came up, because Clive showed him everything. Clive developed the farm and everything for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And he was involved with textiles, you told me. Is that right?
Yep. He was, Carter's Fashions was their business, yeah.
Yeah.
Rag trade, he called it.
Rag trade. Do you know what sparked his interest in Is it just from Clive, do you think?
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
Because Clive would find anybody with money.
Yeah.
And invest with me, sort of thing. And I think that's where it started. He was also invested in a farm out of Dannyberg with some other business guys. I know it was a deer farm. It might have been, actually. I know the block. They went broke anyway, so there was two or three of them there. That they got involved with other businessmen in Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
But then he had deer everywhere before he bought Roro. It like farmed out.
Mm-hmm.
So once he bought Roro, they all came in.
Mm-hmm.
And then bought more.
Yeah. Was there sort of something special about that time that people were buying literal stock?
Well, it was Muldoon's years of Birmingham. A tax write-off almost instant. I think when they developed it, it was an instant tax write-off.
But developing land or developing stock?
Both.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a pretty good attraction because he had sold his business in 87, so.
Yeah.
And so there was a little bit of money sitting around there somewhere.
We needed to do something with.
Yeah.
Oh, golly.
And that was his idea, that he wanted to farm deer. So.
Mm-hmm. And so Ferguson Gully Road, coming off the highway there, it's sort of got something special to it with the trees and the birds and things, and then across the lake, obviously, Mangatautri.
Yeah.
Tell us about what started there at Ferguson Gully Road. And I just drove past today, saw a nice plantation of karakatea just on the highway there.
Well, that's David Wallace's, and sort of started Mangatautri. But Ferguson Gully Road used to be the old highway.
Righto.
And so there's... And then it's all Blackwoods down there. But then when John had a tree specialist, he planted pine trees, and John probably wished that they'd never planted a pine tree.
Yeah.
They've all been cut out by now. I cut them all out. But then we started planting natives, and you got involved with a guy who was planting David Wallace's next door,
mm-hmm.
Roger McGibbon from Taupun. And Natural Logic, I think the company was, and we ended up planting natives and fencing off eroded areas and planting natives,
mm-hmm.
and sort of created a corridor from Mangatautri to here, and David Wallace planted a whole lot of natives as well, so.
Yeah. And did he test the ring fence there, is that right?
That was at David's, yeah, next
yeah.
door.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was when I first came to Roro, 98. Yep, 98. So he planted natives, and then I would have planted probably 40,000 natives in the time that I was at Roro.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all quite big now.
Yeah.
It's good, some good areas, and all the pines have been taken out, but I think they might have replanted them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pain in the ass getting them out, but fences and trees don't work.
Yeah.
So we had some paddocks out. We did it over two period. We had a bit of strife with one of the guys on the road that wouldn't let logging trucks pass at 8 o'clock in the morning, and so we did it over two summers rather than one summer.
Yeah.
But financially they were good in the end. But John would have, I think, if he had done it 10 years later, he wouldn't have planted a pine tree and would have planted natives instead.
Yeah. And the Blackwood, what?
They were like a weed. You cut them down, they keep growing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were along the road. Yeah, they were, yep, just like a weed.
Yeah. Yeah. So you sort of tucked into the hills there above the lake. What sort of, with the contours and the dams and the lanes, what sort of things do trees provide deer farming?
The shelter, deer needed shelter,
mm-hmm.
From prevailing winds, from sunlight really as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty well established also with big plane trees around the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody else probably early on would have cut them out, but because they were in the middle of the paddock.
Mm.
But they were great shade. But when they first started Roro, they put fencing not right on the boundary around the outside, so they put them in like the river on, there's a stream around the back,
mm.
and they planted all that, and then along the road, So they didn't actually take the deer fence right to the boundary, and so he planted a lot right from the start. Bit of riparian planting that we did back in the 90s rather than now, what people are trying to do now.
Yeah.
We did that, what's that, 40 years ago, is it?
Yeah.
Quite, not quite, 30 years ago, 35 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the last sale I was at with you, giving you the hand, you showed me the sort of now popular term farm environment plan, which was a piece of cardboard with the whole thing mapped out and where you were planting and things.
And that was in 99. Yeah. Well, people have tried to do that now, but John thought outside the square and did that back then.
Mm-hmm. So what do you know, sort of what his vision was for doing that then?
I don't know. To make the farm look beautiful as well, and using natives to do that. He thought outside the square, and he was pretty well read, and so he'd find ideas. And like we used chicory and plantain back in 98, and everybody said it was a weed.
Yeah,
and now everybody's using it.
Yeah,
so we had to go and source the seed to put it in with our new grass. Those sort of things that he did. And even right from the start, he crossed Eastern Reds with English.
Yeah.
And everybody said, "You're mad."
Well, what was the thinking behind, you're mad? What?
Because that was, Englishes and Easterns are two different breeds, basically.
Yeah.
And they said, "Why, you don't intermix them. And you're going to keep your English breed, keep it, and you keep your Easterns, keep them pure." But he created a stag called the Rah Rah Red.
Yeah,
and that was his idea, was putting the to get a big stag with a big velvet.
So is that quite ironic, given where the sort of deer stud market's gone now?
Because everybody's doing it now.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as, I think, the Worn and Woven Society, they gave up years ago because there's probably no such thing as pure worn now.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's sort of that story people tell you about, like you said, keeping things pure.
Yeah, and that was the idea in those days, but he thought outside the square.
Mm. So, we're getting these genetics from England and Eastern Europe. You know, there's deer that are native to Asia, native to North America. Why is it that New Zealand can have an industry in this thing that's everywhere else?
Because we do it better, I think they grow better here.
Okay,
I think the velvet grows better here. Better grip, better climate.
Yeah.
Better grasses, I think. Better feed.
Yeah.
And we've got the Deer Farmers Association have got a lot to answer for. They've done a fantastic job, and DINs as well.
Yeah.
Marketed it properly, looked after it properly right from the start. Whereas you like North America, they've got diseases as well.
Mm.
And Russians do it differently again.
Mm-hmm.
But our velvet is known as the best velvet. it probably goes back to the soil, really.
Right. Yeah, it's always struck me as odd that we've got this introduced species. You know, I think when I spoke to Dungan Harm, he said, you know, we saved a conservation disaster and started this industry, and then now it's this farmed industry that's not really competed with.
No.
In a small country.
No. Like Australia have tried it, and their climate, still do, but couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But genetics, they did well with genetics and bringing the right ones in, I suppose.
Mm.
I see there's a guy going around, he's a Mexican, going over to New Zealand last year, doing a lot with AI and that work with whitetails and elk in America at the moment. And that will happen there because they'll do well out of it because they've put work into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what do you think it is about our climate? Like, obviously, you've got this period now of velvet growth and getting weight on the hinds so that they can, you know, drop their fawns and that goes well, and then they've got to recover again, and then you've got to get into mating season by, you know, late March or April. what is it about our climate that means that this period of the year is pretty good and they can recover in the winter?
Yeah, it's a pity they couldn't have it earlier, but earlier, I think, especially with hinds having their calves earlier.
Yeah.
And then your calves would be having the best tucker. Was their best tucker is probably when the grasses are going off. Velvet is getting earlier, and which is not necessarily the best because velvet needs sunshine.
Right.
So the earlier velvet, we've always found, has never been as good as a velvet in a month or 6 weeks' time.
And what's depicting the goodness? Colours or?
Weights.
Weights, right.
Yeah.
Weights for shape though, right?
Yeah, weights. You'll get that it'll grow quicker. Will it grow quicker? It needs the sunshine to make a good velvet stick. And you can see it coming through CKs when I'm there. The earlier stuff is never as good as the stuff, the main lines that come in and when we get it in November.
Yeah. Yeah, so
even later.
If we try and explain good velvet, like you've got shape and conformation.
Yep.
Sort of girth and weight, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So the thicker it is, it's not necessarily the best velvet now.
Yeah.
We've always been trying to grow big Super A velvet, which is thick.
Yeah.
Harder to dry because Asians will dry it.
Yeah.
Whereas the smaller stuff is easier to dry.
Yeah.
But less weight.
Okay, yeah.
I think a farmer will get more, a pretty good premium for his A grade as against Super A. Because it's easier to dry, but less weight for the stag, because it's smaller in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's all to do with climate.
Mm.
And South Island stuff probably better still because it grows later.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to grasses as well. Like down south, they get their clovers is a lot later, whereas our clover here is pretty early.
And you think that protein content is contributing as well?
Yep.
Yeah,
big time.
And then you said about sun, you get more daylight length down there.
The velvet come from we see from the South Island, some pretty good stuff.
Oh, I might have to move. Yeah. one day.
Yeah.
No, oh, fascinating. So, what's it like, sort of still being part of the industry, but not, like you said, you miss the animals, but.
Yeah, I enjoy actually working at CK's, seeing the farm, and I know most of the farmers' stuff that have come through was because the agents buy it for them.
Yeah.
And the agents know who the farmer is, and I don't know whether you've met Alex. Alex is a part owner in CK's. He's a Chinese guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I grade with him, and he just grades on what and a number.
Mm-hmm.
And who the agent was. I look for the farmer's name.
Yeah.
Which is generally on the bin as it comes in.
Yeah.
And I've seen rara stuff come through there, which has been interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly I look for the farmer rather than the agent. Well, I know who the agent is, but look at where it's come from to get there.
If you knew the farm intimately enough, could you know the sort of roundabout breeding or
definitely
oh wow
and Grant's his stuff comes through these, so it's interesting to see it come through just to see the stags that he's bought to breed from. Definitely some of the breedings of some of the farmers that have come through.
Is that also the beauty of velvet, is it so genetic?
Like we had Platinum at the farm in at Rarara, and he could tell his every time a stag came through, you knew it was by him because he tarred him with a brush.
Yeah, and so you didn't even you hit the number and surprise.
Yeah, could tell it a mile off.
Oh, how fascinating!
Yeah, it is, and a good stag will do that.
Yeah. Right, eh? So changing tech, Bill, driving buses in Europe.
It was fun.
How did you end up with that gig?
Right,
I've read the book. What is it, like One Seat Left or whatever it's called, about the origins of Contiki. But
it was Contiki. I actually worked for a rival company, but it was at the same time.
Yeah.
I went to Australia followed the rodeo circuit, ended up in Australia, and ended up in big country up north Queensland. And then, because my mother was English, so the next step was to carry on to the UK.
Yeah. Worked
on farms in the UK. And then the winter of 77, my sister had travelled with Vikings, who we ended up working for, and she said, if those useless buggers could do a trip, take a tour around Europe, you could.
Yeah.
So in about February 78, I must have rung them in London and said, look, have you got any jobs going? Oh, shit, actually, we've got a training trip going to Europe next week. And that was the end of February, beginning of March. We've got a vacancy.
Yeah.
If you want to come on to London, come and see us, and we'll interview you. Yeah, you're good enough. It cost you £200 for a 5-week trip in Europe.
Nice.
Which was nothing.
Yeah.
But we were learning Europe at the same time, so it was a crash course. So that was beginning of the summer season, end of the winter. So we were camping in snow, and but you get to a city and round the city tour, and we were taking notes, no cell phones and nobody GPSs. It was all them and signposts, and then we did basically a 5-week trip around Europe, a crash course in Europe, all the cities and all the motorways, and at various points you had to look back over your shoulder, see what the signpost was going the other way, because at the end of the season they did the trips the other way around.
Yeah.
To take in the beer fest.
Righto, yeah.
So you did 5 weeks and 5 weeks in Europe, got back to London, got a job. Okay, you're on Round Britain tomorrow. So I did a season of Round Britain, 4 weeks Round Britain, Ireland, with paid passengers, but hadn't done it. So the first trip was a courier who had done it before.
Yeah.
So I did that, and the end of the season I did Europe as well. So first year I did 5 Round Britons and 2 Europeans, I think.
Yeah.
Got my bus licence, and then so 79, 78 and 81 I was driving as well as being a courier as well.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
What are some disastrous moments?
Oh, breakdowns. Yeah, and then of course we were budget tours,
mm-hmm.
and not like Kentucky spent $1 million in 81. In 81, it was either make or break. They hired left-hand drive coaches and put permanent campsites in the main towns, and that made them.
Yeah,
and everybody else went broke after that because they
set the standard.
And we put up tents, and we had a lot of fun, and the passengers that we had, I think, had more fun. Well, we could change the itineraries. We did everything.
Yeah.
Breakdowns was probably the biggest. Broken down the top of coming the Pyrenees and Andorra, with a couple of studs sheared off the bloody back axle, and sort of the wheel was a bit sloppy, so I wasn't going to go down. Coming out of Andorra into France, it's
downhill.
Yep. So I was there. I had to wait for a coach to come from London to pick me up. Send all the passengers back in Andorra. Breakdown in Gallipoli. I had a trainee driver with me who went from fourth to second instead of fourth to third, and sheared a cog off the crown wheel and went out to the back of the diff and drained all the oil out.
Oh dear.
And so we ended up back in Kavala in Greece and spent a week in Kavala, which is on a nice beach there. And had to get parts flown out from London, had to get a crown wheel and pinion out from London to Athens, and of course there was a customs strike on, so I had to jump on a bus and go from Kavala to Athens to pick up crown wheel and pinion and come back to...
And what was happening to the passengers at that stage?
They on the beach, and yep, nice place to spend a few extra days.
How did they feel? Because obviously they were on the bus when it broke, so...
It was a 9-week trip, and so they were a good bunch of kids. Well, they were young adults in those days, and we missed out. Barcelona was the only thing we missed out, really. But yeah, we had made up a bit of time to spend more time there anyway. Night drive through Bulgaria or something like that to get around it. But those days didn't worry them.
Was that because there wasn't really, like, there was a loose itinerary? And
a loose itinerary, but we spent, because it was 9 weeks, like, you couldn't afford them now because they were so long. And the nights, were, the cities you'd spend 4 or 5 nights in, you could probably only do 2 anyway. Like, I think in Athens, we spent, would have spent 4 nights there, and we might have only spent 3 nights or 2 nights. So we cut them back like that. I never really asked them, really, but they were having such a good time. And it breaking down on such a nice spot at Kavala,
it was... it was all right.
Yeah.
It was, interesting you say about the, you know, all the camps that Kentucky set up, and then, of course, they had plenty of those problems going on, so then they started up setting up bases of mechanics and and servicing and everything.
So. Well, see, they, but they said they... they hired all these left-hand drive coaches, and they were all brand new. Brand new, and they weren't going to break down. Not, well, we had old Fords and old Bedfords, and So,
and what were they kitted out like?
Nothing under the coach. It was all in the boot. And all the tents went under the seats. And we towed trailers. I think the first trip we had a 25-seater and he had 12 passengers. The second trip we had 25 passengers on a 25-seater, but we towed a trailer. So none of the storage in the big buses like Kentucky did. They all had under, like under the, they were a bit higher in the under cabin. We need none of that, just the boat.
And so did you get, what was the marketing and how did people...
There were big brochures that were marketed back in Australia and New Zealand. A few South Africans, Rhodesia, Canadians, the odd American. But it was all marketed back in the home country. Because the guy who owned Vikings was a Kiwi also. But they had an office in the Strand. And
was he from Denver or something, Vikings?
I don't know. We got probably all our, and all our buses had Viking names. All our buses were named. Don't worry, he was a Kiwi. Les Howe was his name, but I don't know what happened to him. Well, he's probably still in the UK still. But the, they went broke after after I left. And Transit went broke while I was there. Auto Tours are still going, but yeah, Kentucky drove them out of the market, really.
They made the market,
And did well until 87. I think. I've read the book as well. It's probably the only book I've ever read because I happen to see it. And,
and the crash and Whit Sundays and what you're feeling. Yeah. So many things.
Got too big, I think.
It's a great book of screwing and chasing it, isn't it? Like, that's interesting saying about how the campsites was their make or break. New vans, campsites could go belly up or... this could be a big thing. And
it was a make or break, and we knew that. I think in Barcelona, we remember we were sitting up, because the first thing you set up was a cook tent, and then you put your tents up and that, and then, the Kentucky bus coming, and we, in Barcelona, the campsite's quite big, and he was going around and around. We talked to them after, why are we going around and around? Oh, the dinner wasn't ready. So
they were no longer, the tour was no longer even making their stuff. It was ready for them.
It was there was a cook on site, all the big cities. Tents all set up, cook on site. They were obviously pretty good jobs, but you stayed in Barcelona or you stayed in Munich or you stayed in Rome.
So if someone had a place that tickled their fancy on en route, could you pull in or?
If they'd done a bit of study beforehand and say, well, can we go here or are we going here, or well, we would. We found a lot of places that weren't on the itinerary. And that was the way we operated.
So you said that you went to Aussie with rodeo.
You
grew up in Hawke's Bay, right?
So
where's the link there?
We started a rodeo in Akatea, out from Denver. On one of the Lencourt farms there. And then a bit more. And
And so
Gisborne?
What were you into in the radio circuit? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, all the riding events, yeah.
Yeah.
Bulls and Bareback and Bronc. Yeah, so you ended up in Mount Isa at the end of the circuit there. Didn't go to Ayers Rock. And so then got a job on a outback farm,
mm-hmm.
mustering cattle.
Yeah. By horse or?
Yeah, horse and helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we'd go through 3 or 4 horses a week, and then we'd bring another 300 in and take a few more off them. And that was a big country.
Mm-hmm.
It was breeding. The first place was all breeding. And then you get them in and you mark all the calves and all the mickeys, all the one-year-old bulls as well that had horns and balls, and you cut them out and cut them off and dip them all. And then I went to another place which was all just fattening, where they'd come all from the territory, and they were 5-year-old bullocks. They'd never seen guys before, and it was when beef was worth nothing.
Mm.
All mustered with a helicopter.
So then what were they finishing them off on?
Yeah, nothing. But they were fat.
Yeah.
They were fat. And then we put them on a train from Mount Isa to Rockhampton.
And what were they for processing?
The processing, yeah.
Yeah.
Big 5-year-old bullocks, they were big boys. Yeah. We'd kill one a week for our cook.
Yeah.
Just take the back steaks off both sides and a couple of rumps and whatever he wanted, and then kill another one next week because they were worth nothing.
Yeah. Golly.
Yeah. And then went from there to the UK.
That speaking of like genes, that's an amazing animal, isn't it?
They were all short horns, and then there was the start of the Brahmins in those days.
Yeah.
Med and Trotters muster Brahmins with a helicopter, and big Brahmin bull under a tree with a helicopter, try to boom and get the Brahmin bull out.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's when they started the Santa Gertrudis, because Santa Gertrudis is a Brahmin across a short horn.
Okay.
Beef short horn. And get the silver coat.
Mm, mm. Yeah, when I was in Ballina, you killed up there. I drove into Australia's beef capital, which is Casino. And yeah, you drive past these big humped cows.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, walking around in dust, and then all of a sudden it rained, and then all of a sudden there was grass. And
yeah.
I was just like, what is going on in this place?
Yeah, and the soils up northern Queensland were bloody, were black.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like rich soil. But when they got rain, they got a bloody lot of rain.
Mm. And then
you had to get out, like you get stuck there otherwise.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, so we...
That happened while I was there in North Queensland. It was like, hundreds of K wide lake.
Yep.
Yeah. All of a sudden.
Well, and all the roads in northern Queensland, there's your land, and your road was down here because over the years it had sort of no metal.
Yeah. Just all washed away.
Yeah.
Dry and then gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got out before the monsoon. This is like in November. Yeah. Then I worked for a guy in Rockhampton as well. He had beef breeding. Yeah, they were fun times.
Yeah. What were the farmers like? They just keep doing it, or like were they innovative or?
Innovative, not really. No, yeah. just kept doing it. Like the big places up northern Queensland, they were all Vestey's farms. They were all big corporate farm.
Okay, yeah.
Vestey Meats, he was a...
No, I haven't heard of that. No.
They had a big, right up into the territory, a lot of farm, and he owned all the freezing works as well.
Okay.
The guy in Rockhampton was just a family farm, and he had a couple of sons, but it was obviously a lot smaller.
Mm.
Like the place at Mount Isa was 640,000 square miles.
Wow.
Yeah, it was huge.
Yeah. And just... go get them when it's time to bring them in.
Yeah, and so they said that some of them hadn't seen guys for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, wow. So then how did you jump to the UK?
I cruised. I went from Fremantle to Singapore on a cruise.
Was that on a New Zealand passport, or did you have a UK passport?
No, New Zealand passport.
Yeah.
Yep. And then there was a Russian cruise in those days, CTC. And then... from Singapore to London, 5 stops between Singapore and London, via Mumbai, Kuwait, somewhere else Malaysia for the start, because it was cheaper, fuel was cheaper in Malaysia, 20 minutes out of Singapore, and 24 hours from Singapore to London. And then, it was an Aeroflot plane, and
Okay, I was going to say, did you go through canal? Yeah. Round past Africa?
No, that was flying. Flew from Singapore to London.
Yeah.
Cruise to Singapore.
Okay, yeah.
It was a cheap way to get. It cost me £800, $800, I think.
Yeah, and the job when you got there, was that up already?
No, I had cousins who got farms out on the Welsh border. I worked for them for a while. Sheep and beef, sheep farming.
Yeah.
Hop farming. Hops, picking hops and picking spuds. And then that was the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of during 77. And then that's when I rang the company in London and said, got a job.
Yeah.
I want to go driving buses in Europe.
Yeah. And so...
So I fell into it, really.
Yeah. And did you have the mechanical nous? No.
Soon did.
Soon did. Sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah. We had no mechanical nous at all. And I was a pretty shy sort of bloke, so
yeah.
I'd never spoken in front of people before, so it was either make or break again.
You were doing your own make or break.
Yeah.
So what was the support like?
Well, support was pretty good.
You had to find a telephone?
As I said, no credit cards and no cell phone. So another time I broke down on a motorway between Nice, where we were going to doing a night drive to Paris.
Yeah.
And the injector pump shut itself. And so we're at a service station on the motorway. And so just go and get a payphone or...
Mm-hmm.
Say, I want to use your phone to ring London and pay the toll afterwards. So it was all toll calls. I've broken down, and I think it's an injector pump. So they jumped in a van from London and drove damn near to the south of France overnight.
Wow.
And there was another Vikings bus in Paris. So we sent that down to pick the passengers up, and I stayed with the coach and on the side of the blooming motorway, really. Waiting for them to come and fix it, got me on the road, and away we went.
And well, you just caught back up to them.
Caught back up to the passengers in Paris, and finished the trip, and ended up back in London. Yeah, so we had pretty good backup. So
yeah.
If we rang, we were broken down. They were they were on the ball pretty quick.
Oh wow!
Because they did it quite often.
Yeah. Golly, what were some of the best moments of that? Like, is there anything that stands out? Or was it just good level all the time?
I enjoyed Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Several times into Russia. And the one coming from Russia down into the Ukraine with a diff that was shutting itself again. having to get in the air pipes sort of straightened, fixed up every now and then at a campsite. No, I enjoyed Russia because it was primitive. I enjoyed Turkey because it was primitive. We went further than Istanbul right down to the Syrian border. Down to the south of Turkey. Yeah, anything where it was sort of a little bit isolated and less tourists,
mm-hmm.
enjoy those sort of places.
And were you going into Eastern Europe and Yugoslavia type spots? Or?
Yeah, Yugoslavia was all right. They were a breeze. Yugoslavia and Poland, Czechoslovakia were a breeze compared to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia was, back in 78 was a little bit different, 78 and 81. They knew we were Western, obviously, and they knew that things went on that probably shouldn't have gone on, but they knew was happening, but they couldn't find it. But they were fun times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then so how did you end up back in New Zealand?
Okay, so Deb and I met in Greece, and she was with another company going in the opposite direction in Corfu, and we met up back in London just by fate. So we basically came home to get married.
Yeah.
Via 3 months in America.
Yeah.
And so I'd had enough of living out of a suitcase for 7 years. One suitcase for 7 years, and I'd had enough of that. We'd come home to farming, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, it would have carried on when the company went broke and might have ended up in a bit of strife.
Yeah, good timing to get out.
Yeah, it was good timing, yeah. So 4 years was enough, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so where did Rotary start for you?
Where did Rotary start? So back in 2002, Wendy did an exchange when she was at the high school.
At high school, right.
To Australia. She was with a 14 to 16 year old exchange to Australia, where it's called a twin exchange, where Australian will come here or Kiwi will go there into our house for, in those days it was 3 months time. Now it's about, I think it's, actually it might have been 4 months. We might have been 4 months here and 4 months there. Now it's only about, now it's only about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the start, and she went up to Arnhem Land, which is on the way up in Gove.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the rest of them went to Mareeba and Cairns and Port Douglas. And so she did that when she was 14.
And is that just an association Cambridge has with Australia? Or?
No, all of New Zealand and Australia. It's only, it's an Australian and New Zealand thing.
Yeah, but why up north?
Sorry, Rotary. We had an association with our district,
yeah.
9930, with that district in Queensland. Mm-hmm. And the club in Gove were part of the district in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
In northern Queensland.
Yeah.
So that's why she ended up, she said she didn't like shopping, didn't like the beaches, and we knew exactly where she was going to go, because we knew that there were two places in Go where she could have gone.
Yeah.
And she loved it. And so then we had an exchange student from Oslo come and stay with us for 3 months.
And so you're a part of Rotary now?
And so that got me into Rotary.
Oh, right, yep.
Yeah, so it was payback time in 2006, I joined Rotary.
Mm-hmm.
After, both girls had done Rolla.
Mm.
One, Wendy before I'd become a Rotarian, and then Louise afterwards. And so it was basically payback.
Yeah.
And so I've carried on since.
Yeah. And so you guys meet on a Thursday night, is that right?
Meet on a Thursday night, yeah. Obviously at the moment meeting by Zoom, but actually we're actually doing pretty good. We get, out of our 50 odd members, we get 35 there on a Thursday night,
yeah,
which is good. Some of the other clubs aren't doing so well because they don't want to do Zoom.
Yeah.
But we meet four nights a month, and if there's 5 nights, we'll do a vocational trip and go. Okay. Swaps and Matter, we did that a while ago, and it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Do things like that on Thursday night. We go to the Hamilton Gardens, or they've been, we'll go to another club, or, but yeah, it keeps us involved, keeps Deb involved. She's not actually a Rotarian, but she's an honorary Rotarian.
Mm-hmm.
She does a lot of work with Bookorama, and anything that they're doing, she'll help.
Mm-hmm.
Days for Girls, which is a sewing, she's into sewing, so it's a sewing thing that's not associated with Rotary, where they do reusable sani pads for Africa and impoverished countries.
Mm-hmm.
So she got pretty well involved with that. So, yep, I'm pretty well involved now.
Yeah.
With becoming district governor of our 9930 district, which goes from Waipakari out to Hawke's Bay, Bobbity Bay, Bay of Plenty, Waikato, King Country.
Yeah.
So I get a job to look after the 49 clubs in a couple of years' time.
Yeah. So does that mean you're just going to be visiting Rolla now?
Yeah, I've handed the reins. We're handing the reins over. I'm doing the secretary's job at the moment.
Yeah.
Then I hand the chairman's jobs over. But they've got a good committee that they can carry on and do it.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a Carmen Goodman's a young facilitator from Motu Murai. She's,
yeah, she was at the one that I went to. Yeah.
Oh, she was there. Was, yeah, there? Well, she's the kingpin now.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, she's really good. And Libby's still involved.
Cool. Yeah.
She's not a Rotarian anymore, but she loves Rolla, so she comes back and facilitates.
Saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I managed to run into Libby on one of my emergency weekends. I ended up staying in Hamilton at a friend's parents' place. You know, it was classic New Zealand example of, oh, my parents are away, you can use their house for, yep, me and Billy. And sure enough, it was around the corner from Libby, so,
oh, okay,
ran into her and had a good yarn. And yep. Yeah, no, it's still plenty of times that those sessions come back into the head. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Her sessions at Rolla are fantastic, and I think everybody gets a lot of enjoyment out of them. But yeah, Carmen, she's good as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, young blood, and she's keen, and yeah, so I've got Shelley Good is another Rotarian from Morrinsville, is going to take on my co-chair job.
Yeah.
And I'll point them in the right direction, the next rider, and then they're all on their own.
Very good. And you get to show up to the dinner and
yep.
say good job.
Yeah.
Now, it's one of those things that I've always sort of found in my life. I've been in the right place sometimes. Like, moved to Waikato and I was doing the Deer Knowledge course through, they're run by Lincoln now, the place.
Telford,
yeah, that's
yeah,
the one.
Yeah.
And Duncan Hum had put me on the Next Generation Deer Farmers Facebook page somehow, and I just said, is there any deer farmers that, and Hamish Clark said, oh, look up Bill, and he might be able to help you. So, you know, you invited me around to Rah Rah, and, you know, we went through some of those modules, which was super helpful, and, you know, I don't think there was, might have been one or two that I had to add something extra, but, yeah, managed to get through that without, you know, growing up on a farm or anything. And then you sort of sent me a text message or phoned me up one day and said, Cambridge doesn't have a spot for Ryler. It's usually for up to 26-year-olds, but would you be keen? And I sort of said, sounds pretty good. I will get back to you. And I immediately emailed my boss and said, I've got the opportunity to go to Ryler. Is that okay? And they said, yes. And what a week it was.
Yeah. You remember that? I can't remember. The deer came first. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
So deer, no, we get a lot of guys around your age as well in those days, that as long as they knew that they were going to be with some younger people, but they get more out of it, I think, than some of the real younger ones do.
Yeah.
We've cut the age up a little bit now to 20, so that's sort of taken the 18 and 19 year olds out of it.
Yeah.
But you know, the Ryler week is, you put Ryler on your CV, anybody, they know, they've either done it or they've heard of people doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how did you know Duncan Hull?
So Duncan's someone I've never actually met. Okay. I've met Lorna, his wife.
She's a vet. Yeah.
But no, Duncan used to buy Alex's cereal from the Rickana market.
Oh, okay.
And she did, I think they're called Quigley's. They're a big contracting company down in Ashburton or something. And her and a friend through the modelling agency did some promo for them at the Southern Field Days.
Yeah.
And so she kind of got talking to Duncan a bit more there. And yeah, and then she said, oh, Ryan's into deer farming. And so he added me on the Facebook page.
Cool.
And that was that. So Duncan and I have been Facebook friends since about 2015 and Instagram friends, and we never met. We've done a Zoom conversation.
I've never met him either. I've met Lorna, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing. Lorna being the vet and being on the DINS board goes to all the conferences and has to stay at home.
she worked for DINS. Oh, she still does, isn't she?
No, it's pretty funny. And then Hamish said, "Oh, try Bill." Yeah. it's pretty good. But with Ryler, how much interaction do you get with the other districts and what they're doing?
No, none at all.
None at all.
No, because we're all better than them. I did a Zoom meeting the other day because they try to regionalise Rotary into Australia and New Zealand under one region.
Wow.
And this lady in Auckland is one of the kingpins of the driving force. And we were talking, so how are you going to integrate Ryler when there's six great Ryler courses in New Zealand? And because we're all better than that, we all do it differently, but we've all got our Auckland does it two lots of Auckland do it differently to what we do, to Christchurch, to Wellington, and but it will eventually, I think we'll have to work something out that we all do a lot together. They do it different times of year as well, and do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
We've got our own committee, whereas other ones, we have one club will run it for the speaker, they'll get the speakers for this year, and mm-hmm. the next year another club will get it for that year, whereas we do it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think eventually we'll have to do a bit of
sharing. Yeah. And so did you say there's six districts in New Zealand?
Six districts in New Zealand. Will there'll be five next year, because all the South Island, there's two districts in the South Island, they'll join and become one. Then there's Wellington, and there's us being central, and then there's two in Auckland, one sort of half of Auckland with Northland, and a couple of the islands, and then centre of Auckland with the rest of the islands, Fiji and so that's one district. So that's the six districts in New Zealand.
And what's driving this push to amalgamate?
I don't know. We tried it for years. It's coming from Rotary International. So they want to make we're Zone 8 at the moment, which is all Australia, New Zealand, to become run by one board, whereas at the moment it's run by 22 boards. So a lot of administration is doubled up, because it could be done by one. And it costs $18 million American to run Rotary a year. Around the world.
Around the world, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's another driving factor.
Yeah.
Try to get new younger members into leadership roles whereas at the moment it's not viable because it's too much involved. Whereas you get a one council, they could have one administration a DG, he wouldn't have to do any administration.
Would that diminish the each group though? Like, you've got to have some sort of hierarchy in the club though, right?
Yeah, it won't affect clubs.
Yeah.
It won't affect international. It won't affect clubs, but it'll affect everything in the middle.
Okay, yeah.
So the middleman's been taken out, basically.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of getting how we're going to do it and what the structure's going to look like.
Yeah.
So I'm involved with that as well. So
right.
I get Zoom meetings every Sunday night with Australia and New Zealand. So I've gone in big time. And,
yeah.
So it's taking a bit of time.
Absolutely. So you said about how bringing younger people into leadership roles. What's someone going to learn if they're in a company and they've got aspirations for leadership? You know, from the outside looking in, you sort of see Rotary as a place to communicate your business or whatever. How do you feel about someone coming into Rotary who has aspirations for leading a business?
Help them all the way and encourage them to, so the more they get out of it is what they put into something, and we can help them with leadership, even though it's not Rila, to get them involved and get them to get their teeth into something else, either community work or whatever, and then talking with other Rotarians around the district, and not only in the club, but to get involved with everything else that's going on in what we call our district. These other clubs doing different things, and they get ideas that they may be able to incorporate that into maybe their own business.
And so for you, you know, managing the farm, and like I said, you joined Rotary to give back to everything that it offered the girls, what's sort of been you got out of it?
Well, I've enjoyed managing people, not so much managing projects, like managing Rila, probably called Rila a project, the logistics. I quite enjoyed, I'm a D, so I enjoy getting things done and just do it. And if there's anything to be organised in Cambridge, I organise it. I enjoy organising things, and so I can organise animals, I can organise people. That's my theory anyway.
So
I just get on and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much building anything, but organising is my forte.
Mm-hmm. In a town like Cambridge, which is, you know, got 20, seems 20. Everything going on.
Yeah.
What's that been like in terms of a network effect? A network effect of linking up with, you know, seeing what's going on and hearing what's going on.
I wish we could do more, because Lions are pretty strong in Cambridge as well. Okay. I think I'd like to do more with Lions, and I think our new president will do that, because we can put all our resources together. We do a lot of marshalling and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's managing people rather than the president a couple of years ago put a big outdoor
gym park.
And that was huge for Cambridge, and we'd like to put another one out on this side of town. But we do, as a service group, we're dealing with parking at the bloody new raceway, because one of our road unions is in the racing industry.
And, mm-hmm.
We're out at the lake, the armistice, doing like that. We'll do gates and things like that. Our phone book's gone, by the way, because everything's online now. We did a big cookbook a few years ago and made plenty of money out of that. Raceway, we have a big night at the Trots.
Mm-hmm.
Raise money and put it back into the community.
Yeah.
Community house or whatever.
Yeah. And so, like, for example, that the gym equipment at the park.
Yeah.
Is that just kind of getting people out into the Cambridge resources? Like, that Cambridge Lake, there's the running track.
TQD, yeah.
Yeah. And, like you said, the sport equipment. Just kind of something to go to, eh?
It has got people out. You see people using that all the time.
Mm.
Whether it's the end of their run or the beginning of their run or whatever, people will drive there and they'll and use it.
Yeah, it's a little oasis in the middle of Cambridge.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome, Bill. Well, this has been wicked. Like I said, I like that way you finished off there. If you can manage animals, you can manage people.
Yep.
mate, what is something that shows up in your life all the time when things are going well? So I sort of term it as what keeps you in flow. Do you have sort of whether like a mantra or a saying or something that someone said to you over the years?
No, I don't. I'm not well read, so no, I don't actually. Just keep go with the flow, and I do that go with the flow. But if there's something to be done, I'll just do it. That's my thing. Is if it's to be done, if it's got to be done, it gets done.
Yeah,
and leave it to me, and I'll get it done.
You're the one that put your hand up and do it.
Yeah, and I do it all the time, and people will ring me. Oh, have you got the such and such? Oh, can you do that? That was somebody ringing me to help put a seat up tomorrow, I think. If they want to know something about Rotary, they ring me.
Yeah.
Whereas it's freely available online.
Yeah.
But I seem to know it, and that's the reputation I got within our club as sort of a go-to man.
Wicked. Thank you very much for your time, Bill.
No problem.
As you said, you're inundated with Zooms now, and so it's awesome to be able to do it in person.
Good. Well done. And I've watched some of your podcasts, and it's good that you've got something out of it, and hopefully you got something out of it.
Absolutely. It's good, lots of fun, so I keep doing it. Cheers, good. Mate. Kia ora, everyone. This episode of The Stag Roar is brought to you by Sharesies. After COVID last year, I wanted to start putting away some money to create a little bit of a nest egg on top of what I was already doing with KiwiSaver. Sharesies allowed me to invest $25 a week in the share market and see the returns. If you'd like to start investing in the share market, follow the link in the show notes and you'll receive $5 to go towards your first investment. Check it out in the show notes. Follow the link to Sharesies.